Great faith is often found in very unexpected places. I think we would all agree that that's a predominant theme that's found throughout the Bible, and especially during the ministry of Jesus Christ in the Gospels. Jesus found faith in places that you wouldn't expect to find it, or at least that his contemporaries would not have expected to find it. A Samaritan woman at the well, for example. Or among fishermen in Galilee. Or a centurion with a sick slave. Have your Bibles open to Luke chapter 7 at this time. And I'm going to go ahead and start by just reading the story in Luke chapter 7, beginning in verse 2. And then I want to go back and look at some applications throughout the text. So in Luke chapter 7, begin reading with me in verse 2. And a certain centurion slave, who was highly regarded by him, was sick and about to die. And when he heard about Jesus, he sent some Jewish elders, asking him to come and save the life of his slave. When they had come to Jesus, they earnestly entreated him, saying, "He is worthy for you to grant this to him, for he loves our nation, and it was he who built us our synagogue." Now Jesus started on his way with them. And when he was already not far from the house, the centurion sent friends, saying to him, "Lord, do not trouble yourself further, for I am not worthy for you to come under my roof. For this reason, I did not even consider myself worthy to come to you, but just say the word, and my servant will be healed." He goes on to say in verse 8, "For I too am a man under authority, with soldiers who are under me. And I say to this one, 'Go,' and he goes, and to the other, 'Come,' and he comes, and to my slave, 'Do this,' and he does it." Now when Jesus heard this, he marveled at him, and turned and said to the multitude that was following him, "I say to you, not even in Israel have I found such great faith." And when those who had been sent returned to the house, they found the slave in good health. So we begin here looking at a certain centurion. Now, I like that. And the Gospel of Luke, by the way, uses the word "certain" very frequently. When you read the Gospel of Luke, you notice things happen in a certain village or to a certain person or a certain centurion. You know, with Luke, it's not always about giving a specific name, though he is frequently very good at giving specific names and places and dates of when things happen. No, for Luke, it wasn't about who the centurion was. It was about the kind of faith that he showed. So it was a certain centurion. And perhaps in your life, you might be a certain Christian or a certain neighbor, that sometimes you leave an impact with people and it just has to be what it is. You do something for somebody and that's just what it is. You just leave an impact and walk away. And maybe you don't become lifelong friends with somebody, but maybe you're just that person who pulled over on the side of the road and helped someone change a tire. And you talked about Jesus, and you invited them to church, and maybe they never come, maybe they never come to that Bible study, but they might remember you, and a seed has been planted. As I remember, there was a certain Christian that helped me one time, and that left an impression. Maybe you have a neighbor. And we've got neighbors in our neighborhood who seem to like come in and then leave in just a matter of a year or two. In our cul-de-sac, several houses have been occupied and then someone's moved away and then occupied again. And maybe that neighbor is not like going to be my lifelong friend. But as long as that person's living next to me, I'm going to make a difference and leave an impression. And for the rest of their life, I hope that they remember a certain neighbor who was a Christian. Left an impression. That's the centurion. I don't know which centurion it was. There were a lot of centurions in the Roman Empire, but a certain centurion. According to one writer, a centurion, if you're not familiar with what that term is, was a Roman officer who commanded about 100 men. And this centurion was probably in the service of Herod Antipas, stationed in Capernaum, as verse 1 points out, they were in Capernaum. And this was an important provincial town. So, I mean, even though the man doesn't have a name, he was still probably a fairly important figure in the community of Centurion, or in the community of Capernaum, excuse me. Now, one point of note here in the text I want to bring out here is that the slave was highly regarded by him. And this is an important application that we need to see here. The slave was highly regarded by him. So the first application is that reputation and character matter. It mattered with the slave, and it also matters with the centurion here in just a moment, as we will get to. This slave was not just an ordinary slave. He was highly regarded by the centurion. Now, I know that we don't do good things to gain credit with other people. That shouldn't be what we think about. Jesus points out in his teaching that you don't invite people over to your house just so that they can pay you back someday with a dinner party, right, of their own. That you don't help people just so they can help you later. But there's something to be said about building up credit with other people. And even Jesus himself, in one of his parables, pointed out that it's important that you make friends by means of worldly things so that someday those same people will welcome you into the heavenly abode. That as you make friends by being charitable and kind and sharing with them, those same people may one day be able to help you with your needs. And certainly the kindness and the charity that you show is going to be something that is a credit to you in the afterlife. At least in a certain sense you could view it that way. So having credit with people means something. When this slave needed help, he was the kind of slave that the centurion would say, I will go out of my way to help that person. This was no ordinary relationship that they shared. The slave had built up credit with his master. Now, of course, we could talk for a long time about the differences between one slave and another in the Roman Empire and the way that slavery played such a prominent role in Roman politics and in Roman society. We don't have time to really get into that. Suffice it to say, about half of the Roman Empire, the population total, was made up of slaves. Some historians believe it might have been more than half, perhaps 60 or 65% of the entire population of the Roman Empire was slaves. So slavery in the Roman Empire is very different than what we might think of in other cultures. Slaves were viewed oftentimes with very high esteem in their master's household. Slaves oftentimes served as physicians, doctors. The slaves are the ones who were the accountants in their master's household. They were the ones who had control of the bookkeeping. They were the ones who ran the household, basically. So while the centurion was out being a centurion, almost every other aspect of his life was being controlled by slaves. And these slaves were seen, apparently, with very high regard by this centurion. And again, just an important point to make is that when you build up credit with other people, however it is that comes, when you build up credit with other people, and you need to draw from that credit, it will be available to you. Now, practical application here for us is, you never know when you're going to need that credit. It helps in evangelism, doesn't it? If you're trying to make a difference in somebody's life in a spiritual sense, you want to leave an impact with them when it comes to the gospel, it sure helps to have already built up a friendly and kind relationship with that person. It sure helps when you're not in some kind of a hole socially with that person. You know, when you want to evangelize somebody, you want to be able to draw from the fact that you've been a good neighbor. Draw from the fact that you've been a kind person. Draw from the fact that all of their interaction with you has always been a positive thing, so that when you come with the gospel to them, they don't view you as some kind of strange neighborhood pariah. They see you as, this has been a kind person who seemed trustworthy and reliable, who's always been nice to me and friendly to me. Maybe I wouldn't mind sitting down with them in a Bible study. You're drawing from the credit that you've built with them. You never know when you're going to be needed or when you might need somebody else when it comes to a natural disaster or a financial situation or a physical ailment. I'll tell you what, it sure helps when you need help moving a piece of furniture when you can point to all the times that you've helped other people move a piece of furniture. Now, I want to point out again, Jesus is very careful to say in his ministry, you don't do things just to be noticed by other people. You don't do things just so they can pay you back. But it is absolutely true that if you need help moving a piano, and you've helped other people move a piano in the past, you're going to have a much easier time finding people who will come on a Saturday morning to help you move a piano. That's just a fact. That just is what it is when you've been there to help other people. In any case, the servant in our story worked and lived in such a way that he was highly regarded. And when the time came for his centurion master to step in and help, that master was eager and happy to do it. Now in verse 3, when he heard about Jesus, he sent some Jewish elders asking him to come and save the life of his slave. This is a very impressive leap of faith on the centurion's part. And it reminds me of what's said in 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 7, that we need to walk by faith and not by sight. With what appears to be only a passing knowledge of Jesus, the centurion breaks all social conventions and seeks a metaphysical answer for his physical problems. Notice a couple other things about the bold nature of this request. Now, while I understand that the centurion was known for his interaction with the Jews in his community, because they point to that and say, he's been good to us, he's helped us with these things, he's worthy of your attention, it is nevertheless a very striking thing that a centurion, a Gentile, an employee of the Roman government, would even go to Jewish representatives in the community to talk to a Jewish rabbi to seek answers from the metaphysical power of the Jewish God. Let that sink in. The social and cultural and religious implications of what he's asking should not be ignored. He doesn't simply ask Jesus for words of comfort also. I think that's an important point to bring out, that the centurion isn't just asking for temporary respite. He's not just asking that the slave will feel more comfortable during his ailment. He swings for the fences here. He swings for the fences. I mean, if you're going to break down social norms and you're going to go to a Jewish rabbi against all custom, against all social norms, you might as well ask for the moon, right? You might as well ask for the moon. I'm going to ask a Jewish rabbi to help with my slave. Well, you know what? I'm going to ask for everything then. I want you to heal my slave. That's what I'm asking for. Okay, good application then here. Do we come to God in our prayers with the same boldness that the centurion asked for something from Jesus? He doesn't just ask Jesus to comfort my slave or to comfort me. He doesn't just ask Jesus to give us a pat on the back or tell us some nice words. And you notice he doesn't just ask Jesus, will you be there for me as a comfort after my slave dies? Now you see what I'm doing here. Oftentimes that's exactly what we pray to God about. When we find out that somebody has cancer, when we find out that somebody has an illness, when we find out that somebody's in dire straits, instead of swinging for the fences, we just kind of ask for, you know, set the bar really low for ourselves. You know, we find out that somebody's really sick and we say, well, God, please be with this person, but if it doesn't work out, then comfort their families. And I don't, you know, that seems real timid to me. Like, you know, way to really shoot for the stars there, Christian. Right? You are asking the God of this universe, who has power over all things, who has illustrated his divine and miraculous ability time and time again, and you're asking him to do kind of the bare minimum of, well, you know, if the doctors can't do anything, then God, will you just pat us all on the back and make us feel a little bit better here? I think in our prayers, we need to come to God and say, God, I am asking for total and complete healing for this person. I am asking you, God, to do something that no doctor can do. I am asking you, God, to do something that no human agency can do. I am asking you, God, to be God and use God power to do something. Now, if God so chooses to help in that way, then He'll so choose. And if He doesn't, we accept the answer. We accept the answer if it's no. But in our prayers, we need to be bold in our prayers. Bold in our prayers. We accept the answer either way. We accept it humbly and graciously. But are we being bold in the things that we're asking for in our prayers? Or are we just setting the bar really low for ourselves? In verses 4 and 5 it says, "And when they had come to Jesus, they earnestly entreated Him, saying, 'He is worthy for you to grant this to Him, for He loves our nation, and it was He who built us our synagogue.'" Great question to ask then is, what made this centurion worthy? Now in their eyes, they can vouch for His worthiness because they got something from Him. He's been nice to us, and He built us our synagogue. And that would have been a common occurrence, by the way. In the provinces, it was very typical to build favor with the local population by building things for them, you know, building projects and civic works and that sort of thing. Those were important ways that the Romans built bridges with the local communities and local population. Because remember, unlike other great empires before them and after them, Rome's main goal was not to destroy everything in its path. Rome's main goal was to engulf everything in its path and to welcome different kinds of people into its empire. And within reason, Rome allowed local populations to continue doing what they do. It allowed local populations to have their own religions, to have their own customs, to even have their own laws, as long as those laws didn't conflict at all with Roman law. The Romans were like, hey, you be what you want, live how you want, worship how you want, as long as it doesn't conflict with Rome, you guys live how you want to live. So this was one way that they would have built a bridge in the local community by building something like a synagogue. But I wonder, does that really make him worthy of Jesus? So he was kind to the local population and he built a synagogue, but what really made him worthy? What really makes any of us worthy? Now, I imagine there's plenty of practical application that we could look at here. You probably think of things in your own mind of what makes you worthy to sit on a school board? What makes you worthy to have the job that you have? What makes you qualified to do the job that you do? What makes you worthy to serve as an elder or to serve as a deacon? What makes you worthy to teach a Bible class here at Monte Vista? What makes you worthy of somebody's reference? What makes you worthy of somebody's good word? What makes you worthy of your character that you've built, whether it's in the community or the church or in any other context? What makes you worthy of any of those things? Now, there's plenty of worldly measures of worthiness, and the centurion had certainly achieved that level of worthiness. And just like with the slave, and here's that application again, right, with reputation and character. Just like with the slave and his reputation with the centurion, when it came time for the centurion to draw on a bit of that character credit with his Jewish friends in the community, were they there for him? Yeah. When the centurion needed help from those Jewish representatives to go talk to Jesus, when he came to them for help, had he built up the kind of credit with them to where they were more than happy to vouch for him and speak on his behalf? Yes. You never know when you're going to need to draw from that credit. But again, what makes this guy worthy? Well, he was certainly worthy in the eyes of those in the Jewish community in Capernaum. But do they presume to tell Jesus who is worthy and who is not? I wonder, would these have been some of the same people who said that Zacchaeus was not worthy for Jesus to come eat at his house? Would these have been some of the same people who, when that sinful woman came to Jesus and was washing his feet with her tears and the hair on her head, would this have been some of the same people who said that woman was not worthy of Jesus' attention? Would these have been some of the same people? I wonder. What made the centurion worthy? Well, he was worthy in the eyes of the Jews from Capernaum. But what made him worthy in the eyes of Jesus to listen to the request and go through with it? Well, it wasn't his wealth, and it wasn't the favors that he did, and it wasn't just worldly reputation or character or the status that he had attained as a centurion in the Roman Empire. Move on now to verses 6 and 7. Now Jesus started on his way with them, and when he was already... And you know, it says, he started on his way with them before the centurion says what he's about to say, or at least sends by message what he's about to send by message. I think that's an important point, that Jesus already knows the character of the centurion. He already knows who the centurion is, because he's God. Because Jesus is God, and he already knows who we are. He knows what kind of character he has. Jesus started on his way with them, and when he was already not far from the house, the centurion sent friends, saying, "Lord, do not trouble yourself further, for I am not worthy for you to come under my roof. For this reason, I didn't even consider myself worthy to come to you." That's a little bit of why he sent representatives. Now, in Matthew's account, of course, it doesn't say he sent representatives, but there's no conflict there. It's just that Matthew doesn't give the same level of detail that Luke does in that regard. "I did not even consider myself worthy to come to you, but just say the word, and my servant will be healed." What a juxtaposition of opinions between the Jewish elders and the centurion's estimation of his own worth. Those Jewish representatives point to everything that he did. He's been kind to us. He's good to our nation. He built us a synagogue. He's worthy for you to listen to him. That's what they had to say about him. But if you asked the centurion himself and said, "What makes you worthy?" he'd go, "I don't know. Nothing, I guess. Nothing makes me worthy." Be really careful then. Be really careful about all the nice things that people say about you. As a preacher, for example, you have to be really, really careful and take everything with a grain of salt. Because somebody told me this one time, you are never as great as people say you are, but you're also never as terrible as people say you are. You've got to take everything with a grain of salt. Take everything with a grain of salt. Be really careful about all the nice things that people say about you, because they might have an ulterior motive. They might have a reason that you can't detect, at least on the surface. They might have a reason why they're saying something so nice about you. You know, maybe there was another favor. Maybe there's a little something else that the Jews wanted in Capernaum from their centurion. Maybe another building project or an annex or something that they could add on to the synagogue. There might have been something else they wanted out of this. If you ask the Jews, why is he worthy? They had plenty of things they could say of why he was worthy. If you ask the centurion why he was worthy, he's speechless. "I'm not. I'm not worthy. I'm not." Now, this story might have turned out very differently if he had said, "Well, I'm worthy because I've been really kind to your people, Jesus. I mean, they're your people, right? I mean, you're a Jew, right? They're Jews. I've been really nice to your people. I built them a synagogue. I'm not cruel or anything like that. I stay in the barracks, keep my soldiers under control. Why are you worthy?" I'm not. "And I didn't even consider myself worthy to come to you in person. That's how unworthy I am." It can be very easy to get swept up in the moment when everybody's reminding us of how great we are. But when we stand in the greatness of Jesus Christ, it needs to remind us constantly that we are but needy human beings who have fallen far short of God's glory. And without the divine hand reaching out to us to lift us back up, we would not get very far, if at all, on our own merit. Remember what it says in a couple passages here in Romans 12, verse 3. "For by the grace given to me..." And notice, I like this, grace, right? This is what grace reminds him of. In the context of grace, this is how Paul feels. This is what grace teaches me. I bid everyone not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think. That's what grace reminds me of. Don't think more highly of yourself than you should. Philippians 2, verse 3, do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, but in humility count others as more important than yourselves. Proverbs 11, verse 2, when pride comes, then comes dishonor, but with the humble is wisdom. What a great thing to say. For I too am a man under authority, he says in verse 8. With soldiers who are under me, I know my place, I know where I am. I am under somebody else's authority, but somebody else is under my authority. And I say to this one, go, and he goes. And to another, come, and he comes. And to my slave, do this, and he does it. This guy gets it when it comes to authority. He gets it. He understands authority. And that's an important point to make. The centurion is a man who understands the chain of command. Those who are in authority have the power to order their subordinates wherever and whenever they desire. And those under the authority must obey if they respect authority at all. He understands that. And he understands where he is in regard to Jesus. That Jesus is the one with authority over him. And that's a pretty bold statement to make, by the way. In a time when Roman emperors commanded total allegiance from their soldiers, in fact, soldiers even had to sign an oath. They had to make an oath that said, I will do anything for the emperor. He is my God. He commands my total respect. He commands my total obedience. And if I disobey him in any way, then you can kill me. That was the oath. I mean, for lack of more proper Romany type language, that was the oath that they had to take for the emperor. So for him to acknowledge any authority other than the emperor himself, for him to acknowledge that this Jesus, this random rabbi in Galilee with no political power whatsoever, that this man has authority over the physical body and can even command the health and well-being of his slave, that's a really shockingly, surprisingly bold thing for this centurion to say. But he gets it. And just as his military orders are followed, even from great distances, he understands that Jesus can make a command from great distance and it will be followed as well. But just say the word, he says. Just say the word, and it'll come true. Now when Jesus heard this in verse 9, he marveled. That's an amazing, amazing verse, isn't it? The same Son of God who put the stars into the heavens, who crafted every atom and every molecule in the entire universe through his divine will, the same Son who was there in the creative effort alongside God the Father, creating all things and upholding all things, and all things exist because of His power, the same Son of God who has seen every sunrise and every sunset for all time, this same Son of God who's been at the right hand of God, the Father, this same Son of God now marvels at a centurion. It takes a lot to make Jesus marvel at something. When you think about all the things that he has seen and done for all time and eternity before it, it takes a lot for Jesus to marvel at something. You know, when you've seen like the big budget blockbuster movie, most other movies kind of seem paltry by comparison. You know, I feel bad whenever Disney makes another big like Marvel movie, you know, where it's got like 55 different main characters and you have no idea who's who and you're like, wait a minute, I don't remember, what's a Thanos again? You know, and it's so big and so bold and it's like 3 hours long. And then they say, oh yeah, we're going to make more movies. You're like, where are you going to go with this? I no longer have the ability to marvel at your movies because you've taken it so far. I don't even have the ability to be impressed anymore. It's like you get like this special effects overload where you just walk away going like, wow, that's a lot that happened in a short amount of time. How do you follow that up? Yet here's Jesus, who has seen all the mysteries of the universe laid out before him and all the stars of the heavens, and yet here's Jesus marveling. He marveled and turned and said to the multitude that was following him, I say to you, not even in Israel have I found such great faith. And when those who had been sent returned to the house, they found the slave in good health. Jesus marveled at the man's faith. Now, this may have been a hard statement for some of his listeners to hear, since they had a natural prejudice toward the Romans, and especially those in the military. Many of the Jewish revolts that happened in the first century began in outlying communities like in Galilee. Sometimes we're faced with the great faith of people who we don't always understand also. Maybe there's great faith in a marginalized group of people. Great faith in a discounted group of people. Great faith in places that we didn't expect to find great faith. It is great faith nevertheless. And just because people might be marginalized, or just because people might be different than you, or just because somebody might be from a very different class of society or different group of people, it is great faith nevertheless. And perhaps all of this is a bit of foreshadowing. This is a Gentile, a centurion, an employee of the Roman Empire who is coming to Jesus and impressing him with his faith. And the foreshadowing is kind of hard to ignore, isn't it? Because there are other centurions who impress us in the New Testament. There's a centurion in Acts chapter 10, for example, a man named Cornelius, who is the first of the Gentiles to receive the gospel after the day of Pentecost. And notice the connection that Jesus makes between what he says here and what Paul says about true Israelites and the book of Romans. We just studied the book of Romans, but in Romans chapter 2 or in Romans chapter 9, who is true Israel? Who is a true Jew? Is it one who is a Jew or Israelite outwardly in the flesh? Is it based on circumcision or ethnicity or what your credentials say? Or is somebody an Israelite inwardly when they show the faith of Abraham displayed in how they live and how they interact, in their righteousness, in their profession and confession of their belief and their love and their devotion to Jesus Christ? I think this story is a bit of foreshadowing, isn't it? The faith of Abraham, found in the least likely of all places, the faith of Abraham displayed in the heart of a Roman employee, a Gentile. Now, maybe you have that same kind of faith. Maybe you don't. It's time to build up that faith if you don't have it. And it's time to respond in obedience if you do. If you believe in Jesus Christ with all your heart, that's not the last thing that you need to do with your life. You also need to obey the gospel plan of salvation. I don't know if this centurion ever became a Christian. I sure hope he did. And I'm inclined to believe that he did. If he was going to show this kind of faith from miles away from Jesus, having never even met Jesus face to face, imagine the way this centurion would have responded when a Christian 10 or 15 years later came to his community and said, "He who believes and is baptized shall be saved." And he said, "Well, who said that?" "Oh, Jesus said that." "You mean the same Jesus who healed my slave so many years ago? The same Jesus who I acknowledge to be over authority or in authority over me? You mean that same guy said he who believes and is baptized shall be saved? But how could I possibly reject that?" I see no reason why this centurion wouldn't have accepted the gospel message when it came to him at some point in the future after the day of Pentecost. Well, don't reject it now. Whatever spiritual need you have, let it be known by coming forward as we stand and sing.